Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz live here from the Kintech studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. By the way, I wanted to just take a second to make sure everyone knows about what our coverage is going to look like, not just on our show, but here at the station. So obviously, you know, pre, post, the game, we got you all covered. Doing a little bit extra, though. Yannick Hansen
going to be a part of every pregame show with Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. That's absolutely fantastic.
How do we know it'll be Yannick and not Corey Schneider doing
it? I don't know. That's a great question. Man, that would be great. Corey Schneider to do just like dead straight analysis, hockey analysis Hansen's voice.
We're pulling out all the stops for the playoffs. Our pregame will feature Corey Schneider as Yannick Hansen every Canucks game night.
Oh, that would be fantastic. So Yannick's going to be joining Riccio and Sat every pregame. That's awesome. Of course, Batch and Randeep have you on the radio play-by-play call. Our producer, Lena, is going to be doing some awesome social work down at Rogers Arena for every game. And then on the post, of course, Bick, Sat, and Brett Festerling is going to be a part of every post-game show as well.
Festerling rocks, by the way.
Festerling's great.
So good.
Have I mentioned this on air? I think I have, that Festerling and I were co-assistant t-ball coaches last year.
Really?
Totally randomly, our kids were on the same t-ball team.
Very cool.
And he was great. It was awesome.
You guys are like, clear the zone! Just like, won't stop talking hockey. Remember that Vancouver Giants team? Were you in high school then? I was in high school.
What was that, 2007?
I guess you're a little older than me, right? So... No, 2004, 2005.
Okay, yeah.
That was the Memorial Cup year.
Yeah. So I would have just graduated.
And, you know, like Festerling, Franson, Lucic. Mm-hmm. I mean, that team was so cool. And because there wasn't NHL hockey, like, I remember going to a ton of Vancouver Giants games just to, like, get the fix. And Festerling was sick.
Yeah.
But
he's the captain of that team, I believe. Yeah.
And his analysis, it has become absolute must hear. I'm looking forward to hearing him contribute on post games, not just on the game calls.
Yeah, so that's really exciting to have Yannick on the pregames and then Brett Festerling on the post games for the run, for the duration of the playoffs here. And then, as previously mentioned, we'll be getting going at 11, doing 3 hours every day for the Canucks playoff run.
Except on days I travel or have other commitments.
Well, I'll be doing 3 hours. Canucks Talk will be doing 3 hours.
You'll become a tourist.
Available as much as possible.
Can I plug something, by the way?
Please do.
Just like selfishly for myself.
Go nuts. I'm not your boss. I don't know. Whatever. Do whatever.
I'm doing an AMA on our Canucks, a playoff preview AMA.
Very exciting.
Beginning at 3 p.m. because I wasn't going to answer questions during the show. So if there's anything you'd like to ask, go check out the vibrant community at our Canucks. That's reddit.com/r/Canucks. You'll see that I've got a post claiming I'm not Artem Chubarov up there. And you can ask me anything. We're doing a special playoff preview AMA. So I'll spend about an hour there after the show. And if you want to come check out like the hardest of hardcore Canucks communities and ask me a question, please do so.
By the way, I don't think we mentioned it on air, but a couple of people texted in about it. And we did see the Canucks Talk bingo card that somebody on the Reddit Canucks community made. And we enjoyed it very much.
So good.
Shout out to our Canucks for that one.
What was the free space again?
I think it was What's Up.
Did you see there was someone who like captioned the crossover on Twitter, and like some of it was inappropriate, but the main thing was they like transcribed the Rick saying negativity's in my blood and then me responding with oh negative, right? And then it was like in brackets, like, and like they really framed it like it was like a Shakespearean exunt, you know? And it was like Drantz cackles at own joke. It's just like, oh my goodness.
That should be on the bingo card.
I honestly like need that as like closed captioning to just accompany me in my day-to-day life. I feel like it would make my...
As stage direction? Just floating stage direction?
It'd make my interaction so much easier to decipher.
That's amazing. All right. Into the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. We got this one in from the great Locutus of Borg, who says... In the spirit of flying off the handle for the rare succulent joy of the playoffs, which fantastic already, what does success in each round cause us to reevaluate? For example, does a game-winning goal from Garland in Game 7 of Series 1 force us to celebrate the OEL trade? Does it have to be later than that? Does it have to be Series 2? And I got to say, we can get into that specific scenario in a second. But this is one of my favorite things about the playoffs, right? And I think it's especially true in hockey where there is so... I mean, look, every sport is about the championship. Every sport's about the rings, right? But we, like, look down on regular season success so much in the NHL and in hockey. It's so much about the Stanley Cup playoffs that a player can completely rewrite their legacy in a city, their legacy with a team, the fan perception of them with the performance in the playoffs.
But it's only lasting
if they win the cup. Yeah.
You know, so like, I mean, Chris Higgins had an incredible playoff run, acquired to be a fourth line winger, ends up playing second line minutes, crushes it on the PK, warrior stuff. Didn't stop Canucks fans from crushing him in his final Canucks season.
Yes.
Lamenting the contract.
But see, I think that's a different example, though, because it wasn't like...
No, if they'd won, it would have felt different. If they'd won, it would have been different.
But if Chris Higgins had been like a scapegoat for years on the team before that and then had a monster run in 2011, I think it's still different. You know what I mean? And then even if they don't win, right? Because the order's reversed here.
Kevin Bieksa had been a scapegoat on that team for years and years and years, scores in the Western Conference Final, gets crushed for a couple of years as his like speed diminished for a bit. You know what I mean? Like the fact that Kevin Bieksa scored one of the most iconic goals in the history of the franchise to send them to the Stanley Cup Final didn't mean that fans weren't super critical when the Spezza Bieksa pair got leveled.
But it was only
the fact that Bieksa emerged as this like engaging raconteur, the best storyteller of the golden era of Canucks history, that like fan opinion on him flipped.
See, I don't think that's true. And we've had this debate before when he was retiring or whatever, but
you're memory holing all the criticism.
No. I'm not denying that he got lots of criticism. He did, absolutely. But I think that goal he scores against San Jose, it's one thing for them to be criticized in the moment in subsequent seasons, but in retirement, he was always going to be like a folk hero in Canucks lore. Always. Because of that goal, because of the style he played generally.
I think he should have sealed that. I agree with you, but the narrative really began to flip. Like it took till like 2019.
It certainly didn't hurt that like he's incredibly charismatic and a great commentator and all that. Like that didn't hurt his cause, but I think he would have got there anyways.
I hope so, because he was a legit top pair defenseman for like 7 years. He's honestly one of the three or four best defensemen in this franchise's history, but no one's ever said that about him or thought that about him generally, especially during his playing career when he was, you know, oft criticized.
By the way, my favorite example of what Lacutis of Borg is getting at, right, where like hyper-criticized player completely changes it. So this is a totally random poll, but 2007, Major League Baseball. I'm going cross-sport here.
Okay.
J.D. Drew, outfielder, signed this like massive free agency contract with the Boston Red Sox, and in typical Red Sox fashion, the fans hated him all season. He was a total disappointment. It wasn't even that bad, but it was just like, ah, this guy sucks. He's not clutch. No emotion, right? Like, doesn't have the heart of a champion. And then either in the ALCS that year or the World Series, he hits this massive grand slam.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what are we paying him? Like $25 million for the next 4 years? I guess it's worth it. Like, it's like, what are you going to do? He hit a grand slam in the World Series. Well,
especially
that's it. It's over.
Especially because for Boston fans, Boston baseball fans back in that era, although I guess it's a little after they broke their...
No, it would have been the second one.
So 04,
they
right?
won in 04. This was their follow-up in 07.
But still, like, yeah, banners fly forever.
Yeah.
So you get one, and put it this way, the OEL trade, to come back specifically to, you know, Mr. Borg's... he lives in a cube. He's Mr. Borg. To specifically bring it back to his point, my view of it anyway is that the OEL trade was so uniquely calamitous, right? Especially when you consider like what Dylan Gunther did this year, the fact that the club's going to be navigating around the Ekman-Larsson buyout cost in, you know, Quinn Hughes's like age 26 and 27 seasons,
mm-hmm.
when Pettersson's 28, 29. You know, yeah. Will that be easier to take if the team wins the Stanley Cup? For sure. And if Garland plays a big role in that, will we forgive the trade? I think so.
Oh, you have to. Yeah,
but,
have to.
But I literally think it's going to take that.
I agree.
Because especially with the way that this team altered its trajectory this season, you know, like 2027, 2028, like those are going to be big years. If they don't get it done now, if they don't get it done the next season, and then if the $5 million in dead cap hit money is seen to like hold the team back from getting over the hump, you know, that. So again, we'll see, but I think it's going to take a cup win for us to
Yeah, because
that
this is different
blunder.
Too, because Garland has already, at least for now, and again, things can always flip, right? But at least for now, Garland has changed the conversation about him personally, right?
Yep.
But it's another thing to change the conversation about the trade. And that's beyond his scope. That's beyond, like, we shouldn't, and we've stopped doing it, but like, we shouldn't hang the trade on Connor Garland. It's not his fault.
No. Well, I also think we should look at it this way, which is kind of always how I did look at it, which is the Garland. Acquiring Garland as the price of taking on the Oliver Ekman-Larsson liability. Like, the problem in that wasn't that they targeted the wrong player. The problem was that they mispriced the size of the risk. The problem was the risk tolerance.
Mm.
That the taking on the Ekman-Larsson contract should have exceeded their risk tolerance given, you know, how his form, his two-way form especially, had declined, and the amount, the sheer amount of term left on that deal. Right, so that to me is the issue. The issue wasn't like a misevaluation of Garland. In fact, you know, I think we can look at that as something that worked. Garland was a smart target for the team to chase that offseason. It's just that the way they went about it, the way they allowed Benning and company allowed Armstrong, Bill Armstrong, to like arbitrage a long-term commitment in exchange for short-term flexibility, right? Mm-hmm. What was a significant error, and honestly, nothing's going to change that, but at least it'll be easier to live with if the team gets it done with Garland.
At least I don't think you're allowed to complain about it if they win a Stanley Cup with Garland being a huge player. You know what I mean?
But it's not like it retroactively makes the deal
good. It doesn't. You don't have to go hashtag thank you Jim about it. But it's not like, oh, I'm so mad about that trade. It's like, well, but Connor Garland played a huge role in winning a cup, right?
At some point, though, if this team wins the cup with a core group assembled by, I mean, I do think you're going to have to do a little bit of thank you, Jim.
Yeah, that is true.
I'm not kidding either. Like, there's at least going to be a part of that accomplishment that, what?
I'm just laughing thinking about it, but you're so right.
That doesn't mean that Benning himself was ever going to be able to get this team over the top any more than our good friend Dave Nonis or Brian Burke were going to be able to get this Canucks team on the top, over the top, you know, based on their work, frankly, as Canucks and their later work. But that, you know, that discussion loomed large over that 2011 run. And yep. And you know, it was a little bit preposterous. Like, fundamentally, the way that Alvin and Rutherford have, like, stacked this roster with effective glue guys and surplus value and on, like, that's crucial. And yet, you know, Filip Hronek, I think, would stand as, like, the biggest acquisition. And where would you rate him on a list of this team's most important skaters? Like, fringes of the top five?
Yeah. So
debating it with Garland or him?
Yeah. So it would be Hughes, Miller, Pettersson.
Demko.
Are we doing skaters or players?
Players.
Okay. So the big four. And then, yeah, I think I'd probably...
I'd go Garland.
Yeah. I guess the next tier is Garland, Hronek, Besser.
Yeah.
So he's in that tier.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you can debate it however you want. But... So, I mean, point being, like, at some point, keeping it to a thank you, Jim. Hey, we have a lot. We have a long way to go before we get there. But it's at least within the realm of possibility that we do get there.
We got to get Cebulski on the show if that happens, if we're in that position. If we're giving out thank you, Jims. Mr. Thank you, Jim himself.
My God.
Shout out to Cebul. Great guy.
And I do think playoff narratives, too, like, you got to be careful with them, right? You got to be careful with them. Like, on some level, you know, we're going to readjust our point of view about a lot of guys based on what happens here. But you do have to be careful about it. You don't want to blame Nick Bonino for a team's offensive outage and then trade him because you think you need like a bigger, faster center. And he goes on to be a key glue guy that wins two consecutive Stanley Cups. And you traded him because you didn't think he was a playoff performer.
Yeah.
Like, not ideal.
You know, it's fun that the playoffs are going to reframe what we think about some teams. And I actually have been thinking about this a lot. One of the reasons why I don't react that much to regular season results and like relentlessly focus on like 5-on-5 control, right? There's a reason I break it all down like that. And it's because I'm trying to focus like a laser on like what's going to matter when the chips are down overtime of game 7 in the playoffs, right? Like, in the playoffs, are you going to be able to create that environment where you're more likely to get the next goal? That's all I focus on because that's what decides postseason series. It, you know, my whole mode of analysis anyway is built to try and be like, hey, what's going to matter in terms of this team having a shot to win a cup? Obviously, luck, deflections,
yep,
a variety of other weird penalties, team toughness, size, all this other stuff matters too, but like fundamentally, that's everything we talk about's filtered through the frame of like what matters when you get to this point. And it's one of the reasons why even as this team's results have come back to earth from a win-loss perspective since the All-Star break, the fact that their 5-on-5 form has spiked has mattered more to me, right? It's been like, well, this team's control and play. They're generating more than their opponents, even if they're not generating a lot.
Yeah. The ratio is still good, even if the raw volume is not great.
So long as they're able to prevent teams from generating, they're still going to be more likely to get the next goal than their opponent. And that's, I think, the major reason why Canucks fans should have confidence in this team going into the playoffs, like especially in the second half of the year. This has been one of the best teams in the league controlling play 5-on-5. The problem is that Nashville's been better. Like, not by a lot, but these are both top five teams by the metrics that I care about the most in the second half of the season. So as much as Vancouver's form has spiked, so is Nashville's. And that's sort of why, you know, and we've reached that like moment where Canucks fans, quite rightly, deservedly, have their chests pumped out and they don't want to hear anything good about the Predators, right? In people's heads, it just wants to be like, this is going to be, they're going to get through this, da-da-da. They're going to dominate. And they might. But this is the reason why I don't want to use a word like concerned. I'm excited to see the stylistic matchup. I'm excited to see how the Canucks match up with the Predators. But I do think that this is a very imposing side that the Canucks have drawn in the first round here. And I think it's going to be a ton of fun to watch it play out.
By the way, to get just to circle back to the Lacutus of Borg tweet that started us off here about, you know, guys changing the narrative or changing how you look at something. The obvious candidate for this is Elias Lindholm, right? Where nothing that happened since he's been acquired will matter depending on how the playoffs go. And that's one where I don't think they need to win the cup, right? Like, yes, the package could end up hurting if Hunter Brustevich pops, if whoever the Flames pick in the first round pops, that's always going to be a little bit difficult. But if Elias Lindholm helps you get to the Western Conference Finals and is like legitimately good, then I don't think you can spend too much time complaining about that, right? Like, I think Lindholm is the clear, because so many other players have already reshaped the narrative based on what they've done this season, right? Like, it wasn't that long ago that people were thinking Brock Besser was going to be traded out of town. You know what I mean? Like, the JT Miller contract,
yeah,
like the Philip Hronek trade, even if they move on from him, it's well, they got a great year out of him.
And don't forget the downside of it too, which is like, think about how the conversations evolved around Elias Pettersson over the past 12 months. From like, wow, to panic, to criticism. Like, that's been a ride, man.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely has. So many guys have already...
Lady Fortuna's wheel rolls both ways, my friend.
So many guys have already, though, completely already done it. Now, as you said, if the wheel spins, it could flip back depending on how the playoffs go, but if you're looking at one person who can completely change how we think about them or think about their Canucks career, it's pretty clearly Elias Lindholm to me. Like, his story is just, it's all to be written based on how the playoffs go.
Yeah, although I can already sense that the narrative's flipped. Don't you think?
No. I think there's optimism, but that's not the same as it flipping.
People are trying really hard.
No. But if he's a zero goal in a seven-game first-round loss, nobody's going to be referencing that they thought he was playing well going into the playoffs.
The whole conversation around Lindholm right now is, he's getting back on track.
Like, yeah, but
that's the whole conversation.
But if he doesn't help them win, then that's going to go away. That's going to disappear in a second.
Of course. But, like, I'm just saying, that we're already seeing that conversation flip. People are rooting for this guy. He's not going into the conversation around Lindholm going into the playoffs is not beleaguered by any baggage. There's none.
I don't know, man. I think the stakes are high for him, just in terms of pure narrative, legacy, all that stuff. Like, I see what you're saying, that people are...
Well, not to mention his pending free agency.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know what? He might have the most to gain or lose, like...
On an individual level.
But I do think it's worth noting, like, there's a lot of hope for what he can do based on the last like 10 days or whatever since he got back into the lineup. And, you know, I don't know how well founded that is or not, but hopefully he plays to a level closer that more closely approximates what the Canucks were hoping to get when they executed that trade.
All right. Thanks for texting in. Keep those texts coming. 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. As mentioned, we got a couple of exciting guests coming up in the next hour. Dom Lucision from The Athletic will join us, so we'll talk about his perspective on the Canucks versus the Predators, the Canuck chances to go deep, and yeah, we'll probably get into Quinn Hughes and the Norris candidacy in there as well. And then Dmitry Filipovich joins us as usual at 1:30, so stay tuned for that. Drance and I will make our playoff picks with Dmitry in that 1:30 segment right here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650, Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now joining us from The Athletic, the proprietor of Dom's Model, he is Dom Lucision. Dom, thank you for doing this. How are you?
Not bad. How are you doing?
We're doing very well. Always exciting to have you on the show, and lots to get into today. So we'll start looking at the Canucks and the Predators, and 63%, I believe, was the number chance for the Canucks to win this series per your model up at The Athletic. And great preview along with yourself, Shayna, and Sean Gentile up at The Athletic right now. Does that number feel about right to you, kind of subjectively looking at these two teams?
Yeah, I think so. There's always the chance that the model spits something out and you go, I don't know about this one. One of those happened at the beginning of the year when the model said the Canucks are maybe a potential playoff team. And I remember at the start of the season, I had so many people message me saying, how on earth do you have the Canucks over the Kraken? Or how do you have the Canucks in the same ballpark as the Kings? And it's funny to look back on in that realm, but in terms of the playoff odds, it seems pretty on par with where the market is, and maybe a little higher on the Canucks, but I think the Canucks do deserve a bit more respect than the market's giving them right now with the way their season went and how they handled the scrutiny of being PDO merchants to start the year. After that, they started playing some genuinely excellent hockey from a fundamental level.
Dom, you've got in your playoff preview now, the Canucks as 62% favorites over the Nashville Predators, basically in line with the gambling markets, which see it as a 60-40 proposition, more or less. What are Vancouver's big edges going into this series? Why does your model have them as, not a like prohibitive favorite, not Bruins versus Panthers last year or anything, but like a heavy favorite, a clear favorite?
I think it stems a lot from what the Canucks have outside their stars. I think when you look at it line by line, there's a bit of star power that I think Nashville can match with Forsberg, with Josi, with Saros, even with McDonough on defense and the way Ryan O'Reilly's playing. But after that, I think I'm not a huge fan of Vancouver's depth. I think they have a lot more to offer than Nashville, who I think gets really thin after the top guys. If you think that the Canucks are carried a lot by their best players, Nashville is someone who needs a lot more out of their top guys because, I don't know, their middle six is not very inspiring. Their defensive depth after the top pair, also not ideal. And I think it speaks to sort of the lineup construction as well, where the Predators really speak a one-line team. And with the way Vancouver is situated right now, Pettersson, Miller, and now Lindholm down the middle, it pushes Bluger down. You have, I think, probably the deepest center core in the league, where from 1 to 4, it's really hard to match up against the Canucks. I'm not as sold on a lot of the wingers that are playing, and I know that Pettersson sometimes gets the raw end of the deal in terms of the winger quality he gets, but it's a better situation than I think what Nashville has on the other side.
So the people I speak with in the business who are really high on what the Predators have become in the second half, and realistically, this matchup pits sort of two teams that are, you know, top five in score adjusted, Corsi for, expected goals for, whatever you prefer from an underlying perspective, 5-on-5 in the second half of the season. I've heard some folks react to your model and wonder if the model is appropriately pricing in how much Nashville generates offensively. What's their sort of offensive net rating look like? How does it compare? And how do you judge, or how does the model react to teams like both the Predators and the Canucks, frankly, that evolve and become more imposing 5-on-5 over the course of a season?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting question, especially when it comes to Nashville. Mm-hmm. They got a new coach in Andrew Brunette this year, and it took some time for his system to really mesh with the talent at hand. And you had, I think, just a lot of players who played well above what their previous ability seemed like. You had O'Reilly kind of looking like he was cooked last year. This year, he's back looking like a first-line center. Nyquist, I hated that signing so much, and look at him putting up 75 points or whatever. McDonough, last year, it really looked like Tampa Bay dodged a bullet getting out of that deal, and now he's back looking like his vintage self. So in that realm, the coach is getting a lot out of these players that I think it is a little safer to err on the side of being conservative with how good this roster is. Because there's a lot of times where people look at trends and look how a team is playing over the last 25 games or so, and they sort of go into this belief that these trends can last forever, and look how Nashville's leveling up and they're evolving. And the team as a whole just doesn't have sort of track record to feel like that's a safe bet. And we talk about regression a lot when it comes to PDO and shooting percentage and save percentage, but it often gets ignored that sometimes a 60% XG or whatever that the Predators are running at, like, that has a chance to regress as well, because they just probably aren't a true talent 58% XG team. And I get where other people are coming from with the way Nashville has played. It's just, I mean, just look at the roster. It sometimes is as simple as that, where it just, I don't see it holding up the way it has over the last few months since the U2 concert was canceled.
Right. It's really, that wasn't magic, huh? Interesting. So with that in mind, I mean, you know, we're talking 62-63% chance. So as Trant said, not exactly overwhelming favorites are the Canucks in this series per your model. What does the path to victory for the Predators look like? What are their kind of edges or chances to come out on top in this?
One of the things I noticed in my preview was just how Jekyll and Hyde the Canucks power play has been this season. Mm-hmm. And it's not like the Preds have an dangerous power play themselves or their penalty killing is particularly good, but it was just very odd to see how red hot or ice cold the power play was for Vancouver at the time. I think that is probably the biggest way to, I think, get victory for Nashville is you stop power play one, power play two is a complete non-factor for the Canucks, and suddenly it's a game that is predicated on five-on-five ability where I think the teams will be a bit more evenly matched. I think the other thing is, as good as Thatcher Demko has been this season, obviously, UC Soros has a much longer and stronger track record, and I think there's a slight edge in Nashville's favor that he can have a bit more series stealing ability. I know that might be blasphemous saying on Canucks radio, but at the same time, Demko just is coming off injury. He had last year where he obviously wasn't at his best, and there just haven't been as many of those moments for Soros over the last 5 or 6 years.
Dom, when I think about how the Canucks play, right? The fact that they generate so much offensive zone time, but don't generate the level of scoring chances and like danger, right? That would be commensurate with their amount of control of the game itself or the territorial edge. When I think about the composition of the defense corps in particular, you know, there's a prevailing sentiment in Vancouver that, and frankly, one you just echoed, where you look at the rosters, right? Sometimes it's just that simple. I think a lot of what the Canucks do is designed to like hold the puck in the offensive zone, in part to disguise the fact that they don't have a ton of foot speed outside their top pair. When I think about Nashville's middle six, like sure, I might like Vancouver's middle six forward group on paper a bit more, but I also wonder if there's a bit of a mismatch with Vancouver's second and third pair against some guys who can score, manufacture real offense like Novak and Evangelista. What's your take on this theory?
I don't know. It's tough because play style can go in any way. And Sometimes it looks like one team will dominate one way and then their style ends up being a detriment. So it's tough to say until they're actually out there. I do agree, though, that one of Vancouver's biggest concern is that their blue line just doesn't look very imposing after Hughes and Hronek. And I think Soucy and Cole offer some defensive value, but there just isn't a lot of offensive generation from those guys. And maybe that's just a matter of not knowing what to do once they get to the offensive zone or whatever it is. But at the same time, I don't see a lot of legitimate threats on Nashville outside of their own top line. You mentioned Novak and Evangelista. I think one of the dirty little secrets about Nashville's usage and construction of their roster is that they shelter that line like crazy. They play the fourth line and the other line, whatever it is, in
the
way more
line.
Challenging minutes. And so part of the reason that that line looks offensively better and maybe doesn't have the defensive warts it had last year is that Brunetta does a really good job of hiding them. And I don't know if there will be as many places to hide in this series when Vancouver is a four-line deep team with centers who can all defend pretty well. And you have obviously two pairs that are a bit of a question mark, but there's at least one guy on each pair who knows how to defend pretty well.
Dom, I wanted to get into a couple of specific individual players on the Canucks. I want to start with JT Miller, who, you know, another monster point production season, eclipses the 100-point barrier for the first time in his career, but also, you know, full-time center this year. And if you're kind of looking at, I think, players who kind of symbolize the defensive turnaround overall under Rick Tocchet, he's got to be up there. What do you see in the kind of underlying numbers and from the model about Miller's performance this year?
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember being on the show to start the season and I mentioned that Miller looks sort of like an empty calorie performer who gets his points and maybe doesn't do much else after that. He sort of was Vancouver's version of Mark Scheifele, which I think was a lot more valuable than fans gave him credit for last year. I remember at the trade deadline, there were some people who that getting out of the contract alone would be a benefit in and of itself. And it just, it felt like there was an overcorrection to Miller, given that he was still a guy who could score a lot of points. He just maybe wasn't as good as those point totals indicated. But this year, it's just been remarkable seeing his game evolve, especially at his age, back to that prime JT Miller that first came over to Vancouver. That wasn't just someone who scored points, but sort of was a huge difference maker at both ends of the ice. Yeah. I think the big thing with Miller is that they give him tough minutes. They give him the matchup minutes. He is the driving force on that end. And while I don't agree with him being, was he named MVP of the team? Is that correct? Did I read that right on Twitter?
You did. Yeah.
Yeah. By fan vote. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't agree with that, but he was still an incredibly important player that I think a lot of people didn't expect. I mean, he's on the second line. I have him rated as someone who's 14 goals above average. That is probably one of the best second line centers in the league right now in terms of his positioning behind Pettersson in the hierarchy. And before the season, he might have been someone who's average or a liability in that role, and right now I think he's a huge asset instead.
Yeah, it's remarkable because we'd seen him drive play, as you said, like 19-20. He was, what, probably one of the 12 or 15 most valuable forwards in the league outright.
Yeah.
And a bona fide, no question about it, play driver, .. on the wing. And then we saw him move to center and struggle defensively for multiple seasons. Seasons. And then this year, you know, I thought he became a legitimate matchup option. I mean, how rare is it, based on what your model assumes about players, based on what you've observed yourself, for a 30-year-old player to level up like that in a new position?
It is extremely rare. I think, like, you can count on like one or two players doing it per year. We're like, oh, I didn't know he had that in him. I wasn't familiar with his game, type of thing. I think it's especially impressive because he's doing it with Brock Besser on his side, who's sort of getting like the same sort of shafting last year as someone who was expendable,
yep,
defensively illiterate, and look at them go. Who would have thought those two together? Unreal. Very impressive. I think the other thing is
I had Besser will bounce back as a two-way piece stock. I didn't have JT Miller is going to emerge as like a defensive driver at center stock.
Yeah. I think the one thing you mentioned that I think is really underrated is just how difficult the transition from wing to center is in terms of defensive responsibilities. And I think the best example of that right now is if you look at Connor Bedard when he plays center all season versus the 10 games he got to play with Jason Dickinson and he was on the wing, and how much like his on-ice numbers were night and day. And maybe he didn't score as much, but Chicago looked a lot better when he was on the ice, when he had not only that support down the middle, but he wasn't the guy being asked to do all the heavy lifting.
All right, obviously we can't let you go without asking about Quinn Hughes. So should Quinn Hughes win the Norris this year?
I think he should. I think it's a lot closer than the entire province of British Columbia thinks, especially our friend Thomas Drantz. But I do think that it is his year, it's his turn, and I don't think the vote will be particularly close, but I think the thought process behind it at least should have been.
I thought it was close too when filling out my ballot, by the way. I just want to say what Roman Josi did was truly incredible.
That's not what you were tweeting 3 weeks ago. It's not.
That's true. Well, in fairness, Tom, that's never what I'm tweeting about Quinn Hughes. Hey, sometimes people say Drantz always treats Dom's model like gospel, but it put Quinn Hughes 3B. To which I respond, no, that was human error. The model had Quinn Hughes far closer to the top five where he should have been. Just walk us through. We saw the Quinn Hughes jersey on your Twitter account. Obviously, you've been won over. what did you learn? What, like, just, and I don't mean like, what did you learn from a like dunk on Dom gotcha perspective? You know, you and I, anyway, I think have enough trust that we can do a, like, what did I miss from my own process, right? When you're putting together player tiers this year, what will you draw from the Quinn Hughes experience in sort of putting that, doing, going through that exercise this summer?
I think it's something that I like relearn every year, which is I try very hard to listen to outside opinions, to be open-minded, to, if I hear someone I respect say one thing and my model says a different thing, I will often get swayed by that. It's not just Hughes' start of the season. The Buffalo Sabres hype train was out of this world. My model said this team is probably going to take a huge step back. And sometimes it's a bit scary to put that out there where you're like, oh, Buffalo Sabres, they're actually like an 85-point team. And so I'll try to think of ways that I can be closer to consensus. And when we're doing our polling and talking to all these people inside hockey, and they're all saying, you know what, I don't have Quinn Hughes this high yet. I don't know if he's that good. I think he's good, but I'm just not sure. And I don't know, maybe it's a matter of just trusting my own model and my gut and going with that a bit more, because there's been a lot of times in the past years where something that I put out that's a bit contrarian to a very popular consensus ends up being what actually happens. I think 2 years ago, everyone was on the Boston Bruins are going to miss the playoffs train. And I'm like, my model says Boston Bruins, 105 points and top of the league. It's hard to.
And you were 30 points off, Dom.
With those two things.
Dom, you were 30 points off.
Yeah, I was, but it's better than being 40 or 50 points.
No question about it. It that's fascinating, though. The idea of relearning to trust a model that obviously you trust a ton in terms of your bankroll and your professional career as an analyst. I want to give you a theory right now that I subscribe to while putting together my playoff picks, and I just want to get your reaction. So for those of you who don't know, Dom is a Leafs fan, right? And I've picked the Leafs to beat the Bruins in six, and I have this idea in my head that every year, at least one of the four NHL playoff brackets is subject to the stupidity corollary, where the wrong things will get rewarded so that everyone in hockey draws the wrong lessons from X team success. And Toronto is my pick to advance far this year because of the stupidity corollary. They're going to beat Boston. They're going to beat Florida, in part because some of their moves made so little sense. What's your reaction to this?
God, I hope so.
That's perfect. We'll leave it there. God, I love it. Hey, Dom, we got this text in. Wow, I've heard so much about Dom's model. It was amazing to hear his thoughts live. So there you go, man. The radio audience in Vancouver thrilled to hear from Dom Lucision of Dom's model. Thanks for doing this. It's a blast. Always appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to win over some Vancouver fans back one at a time, one jersey at a time. And I am hoping so bad that it's a Canucks Leaf final because the world will implode.
I don't know if we're ready for that. I honestly don't know if we can handle it.
I'll tell you who's ready for that. Sportsnet executive.
That's very true. All right, thanks, Dom.
Yeah, take care.
That is Dom Lucision from The Athletic. Can you imagine the party at Sportsnet headquarters in Toronto if it was Canucks Leafs? Woo!
28 million people watched the game.
Yeah. I mean, you think back to, and I was a fan, I wasn't in media or anything in 2011. Were you in media 2011?
The entire country flushed the toilet at the same time during the first intermission.
Were you in media by 2011, or were you kind of just getting in?
No. I was a fan.
Okay. Even as a fan, it felt like this incredible, like, hothouse environment in that final. You know what I mean? Like, there's just, like, so many eyes on it, so much. Like, every quote is a big deal. Every game is just, like, this massive psychodrama being played out. It would be that
exponentially more if it was the Canucks and the Leafs in the Stanley Cup Finals. Like, I can't even imagine what that environment would look like, what that would feel like. I've never allowed myself to like consider that it might happen. Now Dom's put it in my mind, and I'm like, oh man, it's gonna be a wild 2 weeks.
Honestly, you seem anxious.
I would be.
I feel like
I would be super
anxious. Oh, I would love it.
I would love it, but it would be like a nerve wracking environment.
Oh, I it would be so fun.
Hey, look, meet pressure with pressure. I agree. Ultimately, it would be super fun, but I legitimately don't think we're even like ready to speculate about what that would look like.
I'm not kidding. I think you'd get ratings of like 20 million people per game.
100%. By the way, how about Dom? Deepest center group in the league for the Vancouver Canucks. I see where he's coming from.
He's not wrong, no.
Yeah. I see where he's coming from. And like with all the, again, not to get back on the Lindholm thing, but like Lindholm has to make that the case. You know what I mean? And if he does make it the case, then it's an extraordinary weapon that the Canucks have.
Well, and that's the big sort of fly, I suppose, in the ointment, right? Because Dom's model loves Lindholm.
Yes.
Given, you know, years and years of success. Now, he's actually only got like a plus one rating this season. Actually, he's got roughly the same net rating as Andrei Kuzmenko. So I guess the model's turned on him just a little bit.
But it likes Andrei Kuzmenko too. The model traditionally.
That's true.
Has.
The model has always liked,
you know,
Kuzmenko.
So, yeah. Okay. That always glad to chat with Dom on the show here, and he puts his stamp on Quinn Hughes for the Norris.
Although Andrei Kuzmenko's defensive rating ranks in the 25th percentile,
there you go,
in the NHL. So Dom's model
and Rick
shaking
Tockett.
Hands
yeah.
with Rick Tockett.
This guy can't play defense. Dmitry Filipovich joins us next to wrap up the week here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650 live from the Kintech studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. We couldn't do a playoff preview here without our guy from the Hockey PDO cast, Dmitry Filipovich. What's going on, man?
Fellas, what's going on?
It's the playoffs.
I just can't wait for tomorrow.
It's so good. It's so good. I mean, as much as I loved watching hockey the past few weeks where teams just blatantly throwing in the towel.
So our listeners have heard me increasingly complain about the quality of hockey in the last 6 weeks, but as...
And not just the quality, like there's been a real like existential timber to it. The phrase, none of this means anything has been uttered many times.
It's been preseason-esque.
It's... The problem is that I've been saying this for years, but mostly because the last 2 years the Canucks finished so strong, and I was like, I don't think it means anything.
Mm.
Now, granted, maybe there was more signal than noise in how Vancouver finished under Rick Tockett. Certainly, I did weigh their improvement structurally during that time frame, but like the way that fans of bad teams are like, the way that it's like the Calgary Flames are finishing strong, and it's like, team sucks. I'm sorry.
Sorry to all our Calgary listeners.
No, just like stop it. Stop it.
That's what I've been saying about the Kings, though. Like, if you look at their schedule, I know you've been citing their like point percentage in the past 30 games or whatever, and then you look and like the Canucks are the only good team that they've actually beaten
yeah.
in that time. Otherwise, it's all the other Pacific Division teams, and like you watch them against the Blackhawks yesterday, and you're like, I'm supposed to believe this team is a contender in the West?
Yeah, this team's gonna be a tough out.
Big last-minute comeback against the Blackhawks.
Huge.
Unless Pierre-Luc Dubois is possessed by the ghost of bubble Pierre-Luc Dubois, I think they're dead in the water.
Well, it's really funny because they got that goal late from Arvidsson, I believe, to send it to overtime and get the point they needed to lock in that matchup. And then Kempe scores the overtime winner. And in my PDOcast Discord, I posted, I was like, oh, I can't wait to see someone unironically say that the Kings are entering the playoffs with momentum now because Kempe scored this utterly meaningless goal. And their color commentator literally like 10 seconds later is like, you love to see the Kings entering the playoffs with this kind of momentum. I'm like, oh my God.
That's going to be the difference. It's going to be the difference against the Oilers, man.
But I mean, think about the inverse, which is like, being worried about the Canucks entering the playoffs because of the loss to the Winnipeg Jets last night. It's like, no.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
All right. We'll start. We'll end up going through all of the series, but obviously we'll start with the Canucks and the Predators. So let's just start kind of big picture how you see this first round matchup between the two teams.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really tight one. I think I've seen a lot of Canucks fans feeling as confident as fans of a team can be entering the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I think the games they've watched against the Predators came early in the year when the Canucks really took care of business. That Predators team doesn't remotely resemble the one that's been playing the past 30 or 40 games. In particular, it makes sense that they had a new coach who was implementing an entirely different system. It took them some time to sort of let everything mesh and figure it out. So they've been a significantly improved team since then. I think they're very similar teams. They kind of create offensively slightly differently. The Preds are more of a rush team, but they both love to dominate possession, kind of cycle the puck in the offensive zone, and they both dominate effort-based stats, whether it's the forecheck or whether it's rebounds. And so that's what makes us so compelling, because these are two teams that are going to essentially go into these games with the exact same game plan of trying to just keep the puck in the offensive zone for as long as they can. And so seeing who kind of wins out on that is going to be very interesting, because Vegas or even LA would have been entirely different sort of stylistic matchups. So that's what makes this one fascinating.
So for our listeners who, as you said, maybe haven't watched the Preds closely since the Canucks played them way back in the fall, a bunch of times in short succession there, what has changed? Like, what looks different specifically? What is the system that Andrew Brunette took a little bit while to implement?
Yeah, it's very aggressive offensively. Like, they attack. It's kind of similar in a sense to the way the Florida Panthers play. Obviously, kind of a more moderate version, just because they're not near, no one is as aggressive as the Panthers, and they don't have as much talent, but they compete really hard. They attack every puck. They just give multiple efforts, and you've seen some of their young players come on too, right? Like, I know, Tom, you're going to want to talk about Luke Evangelista and my boy Tommy Novak, but since the trade deadline, they've essentially become their second 5-on-5 line, even though, you know, depth charts or maybe season-long stats don't necessarily illustrate that. And they just have so much more talent than, you know, Colton Sissons and guys they were using in that role previously. So I like this group. Like, I think there's legitimate talent here beyond just the top line in Yossi. And I think people need to respect, like, how well they've been playing.
So for me, the Nashville question comes down to, how do we weight the fact that this became an elite 5-on-5 team and a 5-on-5 team that generates scoring chances like just about nobody except the Colorado Avalanche after the All-Star break, with waiting the full picture? Like, how do you parse through which version of this Predators is the real one, or do we need to just look at the full sample?
I think you need to look at the full sample, but also I'd argue that even at the start of the season, when they were kind of hovering around 500 and outside the playoff picture, a lot of these underlying signs were there. That's why I was kind of high on them, and you and I were waging some pretty intense debates here in the bullpen.
You convinced me over the course of the year.
Yes. Yeah, let the record show, you were a Seattle Kraken,
I was.
Mark, and I was more of a Predators individual, and, yeah, and I think I wound up winning out on that one.
That's a dub for you, my friend.
A slight one.
slight?
But they've been a high-volume offensive team, generating a ton of chances in that kind of home plate area all year. They weren't really converting on them previously. They've started obviously being much more efficient. I think that's helped. It also helps that UC Staros kind of started finally making some saves. And so you put all that together, and I think it's legit. Like, I think there's certainly a lot of signs there that they are legitimately this team, which is going to dominate the puck. And that's worrisome for a Canucks team that wants to play that exact type of game.
I want to ask you the same question, but about Vancouver.
Mm.
Because, you know, through 49 games ahead of the All-Star break and ahead of the Kuzmenko for Lindholm trade, right? The Canucks were plus 64 goal differential, 118 point pace, just absolutely dominating. And yet, a lot of it was driven by the highest combined shooting percentage, save percentage that we've ever seen from a team through 50 games. And then we get to this period post-All-Star break, and it's a negative goal differential, right? And it's a pedestrian point percentage overall. I don't have it pulled up right in front of me at the moment, but it was very much in line with, you know, sort of closer to like our preseason expectations for this team, kind of at the level of like a fringe playoff team, as opposed to, you know, the recreation of the 1980s Oilers that we saw in the first 50. How do you parse which version of the Canucks are real, especially given that despite the results, there's a lot of signs that they were better in the second half?
Yes. Yeah, I think the process is certainly highly encouraging. I'm willing to not throw it out because you get in trouble when you just throw out like big samples of data like this.
Like 50 games or
whatever. Yeah, certainly. But I'm willing to especially give them the benefit of the doubt for the final like 20 to 25 year, because I know the Oilers kind of made that late push and it was like, oh, well, the Pacific Division might be up for grabs, especially to the point where we're going to fly Thomas out to Edmonton to see if this is going to be a big game.
It wasn't.
Yet it never really was. It never really was in doubt. And also, like, the Canucks, their playoff certainty was certainly never in doubt, right? And so for them, for a team that has to essentially right out of the gate play a very specific, aggressive brand of hockey and just, like, be on you the entire time, I imagine game 70 when you're playing a third and four nights against an inferior opponent, the motivation's just not going to be there. It's the NHL. Everyone's obviously trying, all that, all those caveats aside, but it's just not the same. And so I'm totally willing to buy that was a reason for kind of the dip in some of this performance or some of the results, and that come the playoffs, that's going to be back. Now, you could also make the counter argument that a team like the Predators is also going to be equally motivated, right? Yeah. Like it was working for the Canucks at the start of the year where they were very hungry and some of their opponents might have been kind of caught off guard. And so they're going to get matched from that like intensity and energy perspective. But I think that's a big part here. Like, and Tom, I think you probably agree with that as well, considering your longstanding belief that the final 20% of the season is completely meaningless.
Especially by March 15th, once the Canucks really started reducing the amount of ice time that Hronek, Miller, Besser, and Hughes, like all of their ice time went down about 3 minutes a game, five on five. To me, that's a team, you know, I don't want to use a word like pack it in, but that's a team that was pacing itself, that was focusing sort of on the big picture. And yet if I look just like post Lindholm trade, so this is prior to the Demko injury, following the Lindholm trade, like, but right before, so this stretch ends with the Canucks losing at home to the Avalanche 4-3, which sort of broke that win streak that they had with like the win over Vegas, the win over LA. And this is sort of the moment in time where the Canucks begin to really restrain their top players' ice time. And, you know, they'd won 9 of 18 games with a -4 goal differential. So, like, I'm really struggling with how to ferret out what's the real Predators and what's the real Canucks.
Yes.
Just given how significant a disparity there is between their early season and sort of end of season results, even if we sort of isolate those end of season results to like the period of time from the All-Star break to the 80% mark of the season, after which I really tend to look at it as meaningless.
But that's what makes the playoffs so fun. You're going to get a definitive answer. Yeah. It's like, we were going to have all these takes. We're going to try to map out how it's going to look. And then puck's going to drop on game one on Sunday. And then all of a sudden we're going to start getting our answer. And that's where the fun begins.
Well, and what I think is fascinating too, or one of the things about this series, and I made this point on the show yesterday, but as much as, you know, I know a lot of people here in Vancouver are saying, and myself included to an extent, are like, look at the roster for the Preds. It's Mark Jankowski, it's Anthony Beauvillier, and kind of writing them off for that reason. You know, we just talked to Dom Lucision. The numbers say that over the last half of the season, they've been an elite offensive team. And I draw a parallel there to the Canucks. If you were mapping out how the Canucks were going to perform defensively at 5-on-5, nobody was looking at the roster on paper and saying, oh, they're going to be an elite defensive team.
Yep.
But they were able to do so, right? And so I find that matchup of teams kind of punching above their weight at very specific skills, and which, like, when those two forces meet, which one is going to prove to be more real? I find that really fascinating. Do you see weak spots from Nashville that you think either tactically or just because of like likely personnel matchups that the Canucks can exploit in this series?
Great question, Jamie.
Thank you.
You're a broadcasting professional. I've been thinking about this a lot, and here's one that I'm going to be looking for. The Canucks have been one of the best teams in the league this season at creating traffic in front of the net with their screens, with their tips off all the huge shots, with rebounds, just like how aggressive they are in front of the net.
Yep.
UC Saros is quite literally the smallest goalie in the NHL. He's incredibly athletic, side to side. He very rarely gets beat. Like, he can move so well to compensate for it. But against a team that kind of generates stuff around the net the way the Canucks do, I think it's going to be really challenging for him to like establish those sight lines and like get around to seeing pucks cleanly. And so for like, that's music to the Canucks' ears, right? Like, that's exactly what they're going to try to accomplish. So Saros is so good. He's one of the best goalies in the league, has been for years. So if there's anyone that can kind of overcome it and just still make miraculous saves, it's him. But like, that's something I would be just harping on if I were Rick Tocchet.
But isn't there a risk? Like, we've seen when this team is occasionally like sputtered playing 500 hockey, the offense becomes a little predictable in terms
I think it's okay for to have that as one of the things you're looking for, but I think sometimes the dial gets turned a little too much away from the other stuff, right? It's too prioritized, and like you're saying, like it should be music to Rick Tocchet's ears. I bet it is.
Yeah.
Like I bet he's like,
right now he's rubbing his hands together.
Let's go. But yeah. I guess it is a concern. Like, do you become too obsessed with that and kind of punt on the other ways of generating
offense? I know that like layered screens where the puck hits the top of the net are like a 43% shot, and that's fine. But what percentage of point shots result in that? You know what I mean? Like, are you sure it's better than the anyway? I think this is going to be part of what's fascinating. Like, I love to see almost an old school offense versus defense series, especially because for so much of our lifetime, defense has beaten offense in the NHL. And this season, especially, but really over the last few years, it's kind of felt like the way that teams have had to play to win, like Vegas had to level up in terms of how they prioritize generating quality shots to actually get over the hump. Colorado, obviously we know what Tampa Bay can do offensively, right? It's been a while since a like Daryl Sutter Kings style cup champion emerged.
Also, we should say like neither of these teams are necessarily the Colorado Avalanche or even like whatever other team you want to think of in terms of being able to be down 5-2 or something and just immediately turn it on for like 7 minutes and score a bunch of goals and totally flip the game on its head, right? Like both these teams can score goals certainly, and they have this season, but they do it in a much more methodical way and also like very controlled manner. And so it kind of goes without saying, like if you jump out to an early lead, especially a multi-goal lead, that's generally bodes well for you in the NHL postseason. But I think like this is the series out of any that's probably like the biggest thing I'm going to be looking for, especially we've talked so much about the Canucks starting hot, scoring in the first 5 minutes, yes, and then kind of being able to play their game. That's obviously going to dictate this as well, where if they go down early, I would be a bit nervous about their ability to like open it up and trade chances with the Predators.
So
Drance just raised his hand. Like, we're in class. Like, yes, Thomas?
We've got a lot to get through because we're going to do a Conn Smythe odds draft, but I also want to do our Stanley Cup first round playoff picks. Do you have your picks? Are you willing to do this with us?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sick. Jamie, you in?
Do we have to do like specific game amount?
You can.
Yes.
Okay, let's do it. Sure.
Dim's not usually in the picks business, so if he wants to just pick...
Laziest form of analysis. People pass it off and they're like, there you go, I did it.
I want to... Like, fair. I don't care if my picks are wrong. Yeah. I just want to put that out there.
Yes, that's important.
So let's go rapid fire here so that we can get to the good stuff, which is drafting things.
Let's do it.
Okay?
Right. Yes.
Let's start.
This whole show is just a vehicle to toward the draft.
We're killing 20 or so minutes.
Until we get to the draft.
Yeah. I do a whole show on drafting stuff. Are you kidding me?
I know you would.
We should draft drafts.
Yeah. We should draft. I'm down with that. Yeah, okay. A draft?
Yeah.
And like draft beers. We should draft draft draftsmen. Like we should draft all sorts of drafting things. All right. Let's start with Stars versus Golden Knights. I'm guessing we're uniform on Dallas here. We're all riding Dallas.
Dallas and five.
Yes, Dallas and five. Actually,
Dallas and five.
Yes.
A clean sweep.
Yeah.
A family pick.
I've never felt more confident that Vegas is winning the series.
Yeah. Okay. Jets, Colorado. I got Jets in seven.
I'm going to take Colorado in six.
I got the Jets in six. I think it's a really good matchup for the Jets.
Yeah, I agree with you. Colorado needs to like actually show me that they can play in their own end.
Yeah. They also had a horrible final stretch of the season, which might not matter, really tough to forget about it because it was against like important opponents too.
They just looked lost in their own end.
And they were playing for home ice, which you're going to see in the series, right? Mm-hmm. Like losing 7-0 at home to Winnipeg in an important game is not a throwaway one for me.
You can't get motivated to limit your time in Winnipeg. It might be real. Canucks, Nashville. I've got Canucks in seven.
I'm going to take the Canucks in five.
Okay.
I'm manifesting a lot of things in these picks, so I'm taking Canucks in five.
Nice. I like it. I got Canucks in seven as well.
For me, I appreciate it.
I know you don't want to make that game six trip.
Although, baby, I got a direct flight home. I got a direct flight home. It was like Christmas. Okay.
Yeah, Canucks in seven as well.
Yep. So, clean sweep on Canucks.
Yeah.
I got Oilers in five.
Yeah, I was tempted to go sweep, but I'll give the Kings a game. Oilers in five.
Okay, I'll go Oilers in six then, just because, you know, it's the Oilers. They're going to have a game or two where they, like, score in their own net or something.
So we have one series we disagree on,
yes,
the three of us.
Where I took Colorado,
yeah,
and you guys took Winnipeg.
The PDO report hive mind. Yeah. Is
well, these are all
strong
favorites, other than I think the Avs are probably favorite.
The Avs,
line,
are
right?
Very.
So
narrowly
I took
favorite.
Every favorite. Okay. Nice. Going out on a limb here. Rock chalk Jayhawk, baby.
That's why we call you Chalky Dodd. No one's ever called you that, and no one ever will again. All right, Panthers versus Lightning, the battle of Alligator Alley, a thing that only I've ever called it. I tried to make it a thing. It never worked.
I'm taking Florida in 7.
Yeah, I got Florida in 5.
I got Florida in 7.
Yeah.
So another clean sweep. I got Leafs in 6.
See, this is why we need the games to differentiate a little bit.
Yeah,
totally. I got Leafs in 6.
This is more manifesting. Bruins in 7.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I got Leafs in 7.
There we go. I've got Rangers in 6. I want to explain this one because I was tempted to make this my sweep. I always pick one sweep every first round. I've got Rangers in 6. I'm not picking this to be my sweep despite the Washington Capitals' abysmal goal differential because they've got tough guys, they've got good special teams, and you know Charlie Lindgren's just going to like make the Rangers sweat at some point. Mm-hmm. So I've got Rangers in 6.
I'll take Rangers in 5.
Yeah, me as well. It would be funny if the Capitals won this series with like a minus 10 goal differential in the series, though, because they win 4-1 goal games and lose the others by like 10.
Massive
like,
amounts. That would be awesome.
Massive
actually.
Commitment to the bet.
And then I've got a Hurricane sweep over the New York Islanders.
Yes. Same.
Yeah, I'll go 5 just because the Islanders will steal one, but yeah.
Yeah. Their power
I think
play,
we're pretty in unison there.
Their power play is dangerous. No, yeah. I mean, that was a wild amount of agreement. We had one disagreement in the Leafs Bruins series and one disagreement in the
Colorado
Jets Avalanche series.
Which, to be fair, I think are probably the two closest series of the first round.
Yes. Also, kudos to us for being company men. We have 4 Canadian teams advancing
in the
second round.
I have Boston.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Well, be a better employee, bro. Okay.
This will come up at your next performance review.
Exactly.
We got to run through our Conn Smythe draft. I'm going to give Dimitri the first pick here. So we are picking Conn Smythe odds.
All right.
Long shot bets.
Most likely.
Yeah. No, most likely. Well, I mean, the best value.
Right.
The ones you want.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll go first. I've got Seth Jarvis plus 14,000.
Oh,
140 to 1 for Seth Jarvis, who I think is a good bet to lead the Hurricanes in scoring. I think the Hurricanes are a good bet to come out of the East and at least participate in the Stanley Cup final. And so I know they have a ton of options there, but he's just wildly mispriced compared to like guys like Svechnikov, who I just think he's so much more likely to outscore.
Wait, you're using FanDuel. Excuse me.
You just use whichever one you want. If you can find it, this is what every podcast says, right? They're like,
that's a good point.
Line shop, you know? Always look for the best line.
No, always use Play Now Sports. Our good
well.
Fans.
All right, me?
Yeah.
Okay, I will take Jake Oettinger plus 2,000. I think Dallas is really good, and he's a goalie.
That's true.
So there you go.
That's good logic.
He is
Thank
a
you.
Goalie. I appreciate that. Okay, I'm going to go with...
I got Jake Oettinger plus 3,000. I'll give you even better odds than
that. Wow, look at that. This is why you got to shop around.
So I get 2 picks consecutively. I want Wyatt Johnston of the Dallas Stars at plus 10,000. And I want Logan Stankoven. I'm just in on that line. I think what we're about to see from that line is like shades of Braden Point in the bubble, you know, where they're just like the line that keeps scoring the key goals for the Stars, and then at the end of it, you know, they have like 23 points each, and they get really close. And at the very least, I'm getting a sick cash out offer. He's plus 25,000, Logan Stankoven.
Is it me?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I'll take Matthew Tkachuk, also plus 2,000. I'm not going long shots. I'm going good players on teams I think are going to go really deep. So
okay,
I'll take Matthew Tkachuk plus 2,000.
I got Logan Stankoven for the same odds that Simone Benoit has. So
I like that.
Basically, I didn't want to scroll down that far on the list of odds.
You know what? I'm going to go with Adam Fox plus 6,500.
That's a good one.
I just think like Mika Zibanejad's a significantly higher favorite than him, and I don't really envision a scenario. I know he can score a lot of goals, but like it feels like if they go on a Stanley Cup run, Adam Fox will be playing so many more minutes than any of the other players. So,
okay, and you get one more.
I do, hey?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Give me Alexander Barkov.
Yeah,
plus 3,000.
I like it.
Similar to what Jamie just said about Matthew Tkachuk.
I like it a lot.
I'm going to take this is like
You're going to make the homer exciting pick. No, I'm not. I'm going to make the least exciting pick possible, which is Connor McDavid at plus 1,000.
Nice.
Best player on the planet.
Yeah.
Not bad.
That's probably the winner.
It's a good pick. I'm going to take Jake Guentzel.
That's a good pick.
Plus 2,500.
Playoff hero, Jake Guentzel.
Yeah, 25-1 that Jake Guentzel on one of the best teams in the East, with probably the easiest path through the playoffs given the quality of their first round opponent. I picked Jake Guentzel.
So we were Canes, Stars. I had McDavid. Oh, Canes, Stars, Panthers, and then I had McDavid, and you had Adam Fox.
Yeah, if you're doing this at home, I would say the best is just pick two or three teams you like really like to win the cup or at least participate, and then just take their guys.
Rather than taking the best player
on every team.
Yeah, indeed. All right, that's it. Game one on Sunday. We're going to be playing other playoff games earlier on the station. Then we'll have, I know Josh Elliott Wolf's doing like a 2-hour pre-game show, 2 hours of actual pregame with Yannick Hansen joining Satyar Shah and Dan Riccio. So it's going to be a massive day on Sunday for the station, for the city, for fans. Enjoy it. Have a blast. And we will talk to you on Monday. Before we go, JanPro, the leaders in commercial cleaning and janitorial. If your workplace demands a clean environment, contact JanPro for a free no-obligation quote. Visit janpro.ca. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.